The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā Sambuddhasa. Good evening. How are you today? It's nice to be back again. So, this evening, I decided to talk about the Sambuddha Jayanti. I guess you all know what the Sambuddha Jayanti is and the significance of it. Because the Sambuddha Jayanti is the 2600th Enlightenment Day of the Blessed One. And it fell last month on the full moon day. And most of the Theravada Buddhists all over the world celebrated it in a big way. They had a very, very big celebration at the UN. And there were about 250 priests there. And for the first time at the General Assembly, they even chanted the blessings. There were very big ceremonies all over the world in other countries too. Now, the Vesak festival celebrates the three major events in the life of the Blessed One. His birth, enlightenment, and parinibbana. That's passing away. So under the full moon, on the month of May, Prince Siddhartha was born. Under the full moon day, the month of May, the ascetic Gautama attained enlightenment. Under the full moon day, in the month of May, our Lord reached his final liberation. So it is to honor him that we all celebrate the full moon of May. Now, Prince Siddhartha, the son of King Suddhodana and Queen Maya, was born in the Lumbini Park. Their hometown was Kapilavastu. And then again under the sal trees. He was a normal human being, born to normal human parents under normal human conditions. But his birth is said to be a miraculous birth, because as he was born, the infant took 7 steps. And with each step, a lotus sprang up to hold the delicate foot of the child. So he stood on the 7th lotus and he gave his first lion's roar. He said, "I am the greatest in the world. I am the most senior. I and the most supreme. This is my last birth. No more rebirth for me." Now, according to the story, I guess we all know that he got married at the age of 16, according to the Indian culture, Indian customs. And even though he was living in all the luxury, he was a very, very person who was thinking about what is happening in the world. He wanted to find the answers for old age, sickness, death, and suffering. So at the age of 29, he decided to make his great renunciation. And that was the very day that his wife gave birth to his son. So the first thing, when he heard that a son was born to him, the first thing that came to his mind was, now I'm going to be attached to the world. I will have to lead a worldly life. But I guess his paramis and his determination was so great that he was able to conquer all that and leave the palace and go in search of the truth. His noble quest took him 6 years. First, he went to 2 great teachers that were there during that time. He learned everything that those teachers had to teach him, but he found that that was not the answer that he was looking for. They were great. They had many, many wonderful things to teach him. He learned a lot, but that did not bring him freedom from suffering. Then he decided that, like everyone else at that time thought, self-mortification was the way to liberation. So he went to the forest to practice self-mortification. And there he met 5 other ascetics who accepted him as a leader and helped him. Now I'm going to go a little bit back and tell a little bit about these 5 ascetics that he met. These 5, see, when Prince Siddhartha was born, the king invited 5 wise men that were there in the country to come and predict the child's future. So out of these 5, 4 predicted that he will become either a world-ruling king or a Buddha. The youngest and the last one said, no, he's only going to be a Buddha. So these 5 ascetics, 4 of them were the sons of these 4 older ones. When the 4 older ones knew that they were going to die because they were old and they will be there, so they asked their sons to go take to asceticism and be ready there when Prince Siddhartha becomes a Buddha to be his disciples. The 5th one was the youngest at that time, Kondanja. So now he's the oldest of the 5. So these were the 5, and they knew that if anyone in this world could break through and become a Buddha, this guy is the one. So they followed him and helped him. So he practiced asceticism very, very strict asceticism. And he even said, there's no one in the world who has ever practiced such strict asceticism as he is, and no one ever will. But he was almost on the verge of death when he thought, this cannot be the way to liberation. He thought, I will die before I find answers. So then he was contemplating and trying to think, could there be another way? This can't be the way. When he was thinking, asking the question, could there be another way, the thought came to him. He remembered from his past. When he was a child, he was during the father's plowing festival, he was sitting under a rose apple tree. And while he was sitting there, spontaneously he took to the breathing meditation in and out breathing. And he attained the first jhana. And he realized, he remembered the blissful state that he was in. How blissful, how pleasant, how wonderful that state is. Then he asked the question, could that be the way to enlightenment? And the insight rose in him, yes, that is the way to enlightenment. Then he looked at his body and thought, with this body, there's no way will I be able to practice the mindfulness of meditation and get to jhanas. So he started to eat and to take baths and regain his weight, let's regain his former self. When the five ascetics saw that, they got so disgusted with him and said, he has reverted to back to luxurious life, and they abandoned him. I think that was the best thing that happened. So left alone to find his own path to deliverance, he was walking around to find a suitable spot to make his home. Then he found this nice shady tree with a river that is close by, and there was a small village in the area too. So he thought this would be a good place for me. And then he started taking baths, he started eating and practicing under the tree. Now I'm going to go a little bit again with another story. Now there was this lady, a rich, well-known, prominent lady in that village named Sujata. She had made a vow to the tree spirit that was there. If she had a male child, she'll make an offering to the tree spirit. So she had her male child and she was preparing the offering to make to the tree spirit. So she sent her maid to go and clean up under the tree. When the maid came, she saw this very handsome looking man radiating and sitting under the tree. He quickly ran home and said, lady, the tree spirit is sitting under the tree waiting for you. So she quickly put her offering of food into a golden bowl and came and made the offering to the Bodhisattva. So he had his meal and then he went to the river to wash his bowl. And after he washed his bowl, the thought came to him, if I'm going to reach my goal tonight, let this bowl flow upstream. And he threw the bowl into the river. How many of us will throw a golden bowl into a river? So the bowl did go upstream. And now I guess that must have given him some confidence. So he had his cleaned up, he's all now ready to come. And walking from the river to the bow tree, it was not called the bow tree at that time, he found these water buffalo boys going home with bundles of grass. And those boys offered him some grass to make a seat. So he made a comfortable seat under the tree. And he sat down under the tree with the firm determination that he will not get up from that tree till he attained his final liberation. So to him it was liberation or bust. So now While you were sitting there, practicing mindfulness of breathing, and you went up to the fourth jhana. And then, that during the first watch of the night, the knowledge came to him about his past lives. So he went, he saw many of his past lives, way back, many lifetimes back. During the second watch of the night, he saw karma and rebirth, how people, according to their karma and rebirth, went from one birth to another and went round and round in samsara. And during the third watch of the night is when he broke all the fetters one after the other and lifted the veil of delusion, darkness, and then the light of wisdom arose in him. And that is when he became the Samma Sambuddha, or the self-awakened one. So, to become the self-awakened one, what he did was, he developed the middle way and realized the true Dhamma. So, his enlightenment put an end to, finally he put an end to old age, sickness, death and suffering. Not only for himself, but for all beings. So it is because of his enlightenment that that became the cause, that was the cause of our liberation too. If not for his enlightenment, we would have been spinning round like the sheep following the leader, round and round and round in samsara. So the Blessed One's enlightenment is the central event in Buddhism, and that is what we all aspire to. The wisdom and the light that arose and radiated from under the Bodhi tree 2600 years ago is of great significance to all beings, as it illuminated the way by which we can aspire to eradicate our defilements and reach the world of light, of true love and happiness. So Vesak gives us an opportunity to reflect on the life and the teachings of the Buddha, and also to reflect about our own inner potential for peace and happiness that is there within each and every one of us. And the significance of Vesak is his universal peace message to all mankind. That is non-violence, universal love, compassion. Now this message of the Buddha that he enunciated 2600 years ago is relevant even today. Today with all this unrest, all this violence, I think if all beings, people, if all learn to practice non-violence, universal love and compassion, the world will be a better place today. Now, if you look at the enlightenment, we know that it is not a revelation from a higher power above. It is a self-realization. He realized it all by himself, and now he said we can all realize the same thing that he realized. So it is an illumination that came from within. He was able to see the true nature of things as they really are. See, what happened? Now we don't see things as they really are because we are all shrouded by ignorance. See, we have to lift that veil of darkness to see things as they truly are. But that is what happens when we meditate. A little bit of that is lifted and we see a little bit of things as they truly are. What he really saw was the causal relations or the dependent origination, paticca-samuppada. That was the key to his enlightenment. So the Buddha taught the Noble Eightfold Path as the right path leading to emancipation, happiness and realization. It's a straight and narrow path between sensual desire on one side and self-mortification on the other side. If we take the essence of the Buddha's teachings during his 45-year mission, we can see the immense worth and true significance of Vesak. In his teachings, we have a theory of knowledge, a theory of reality, moral law, social and political philosophy. Now we'll take the theory of knowledge. Nature operates on natural laws based on causal conditions. Now these are non-deterministic causal correlations. Now the events of nature does not happen in a haphazard way, nor are they due to the will of a higher being up there. Nor are they determined. They are not fate. They are not things that happen by chance. And not even luck. Sometimes we think, wow, I'm lucky. Something, this happened to me. No, it's not luck. It's all causally created. Everything that happens in the world, outside or within us, they're all causally created. But it's not one cause and one result. It's many causes and many results. It's so complex that it is very difficult for us to see that. So the Buddha's teachings on the dependent origination, that is paticca-samuppada, it takes us between the two extremes. So it is neither determined nor is it indeterminate. So we cannot say something happened because that is determined, that's our fate. See, sometimes people tend to think that, oh, that's my fate. Sometimes we even use the word, oh, that's my karma. That's the easiest thing that we can say is, that's my karma. And no, karma is only one cause. There are many, many, actually there are 24 causal conditions that can happen. So karma is just one of those causes. So it's very complex, it's very hard for us to understand this. But it is not determined, nor can we say it is not indeterminate either. We really don't have a free licensing to do or free choice to do anything that we want, because there is, to some extent, we have the freedom, we have free will, but it's all conditioned. So the dependent, but the teachings of the Buddha are not to be, again, he says, don't believe it without understanding. It's not blind faith. It is based on understanding. So understanding is the key to salvation. For understanding to happen, we need to look at things in an impartial way. Now, how do you look at things in an impartial way? Most of the time, when we look at things, we look at things through our likes and dislikes. We have our own opinions, our views, our likes, our dislikes, and also we are influenced by our fear. That is how most of the time we all look at things. So, to look at things impartially, we have to let go of our likes and dislikes. We have to let go of our fear. And we have to not be have our strong opinions, our views about it. Look at things in an objective way, not subjective. And he said, there must be personal verification and realization. That is how we can get the truth, through personal verification and realization. Now, how do we gain personal realization? Now here, the Buddha gave his famous Kalam Sutta. How many of you know about the Kalam Sutta? I guess you all know it. Okay, so now in the Kalam Sutta he says, I think the Buddha is the only one religious teacher who said, don't even believe me. You better find out for your own self and then believe. In the famous Kalam Sutta he says, we do not rely on authority. Whether it is a revelation, tradition, hearsay written in the scriptures. Even if it's the view of the experts or a revered teacher, do not believe it. We must not rely on pure reasoning alone, nor look at things from just one standard point, nor trust the superficial examination of things, nor base our theories on a preconceived opinion. So he had 10 different things that he had stated not to do, even if it came from. And finally he said, don't even believe because I said it. You'll have to find out for your own self. Verify, use your own experience. And there is a nice thing in the scriptures about how he was talking to Venerable Sariputta, and he was telling Venerable Sariputta something, and after he finished that, he asked Sariputta, do you believe it? He said, "No, Lord, I don't believe you." It. Then he said, "I have, because I have still not experienced it." He praised him and he said, "This is how I want everyone to be. Don't believe because I said experience it. Find it out for your own self." Wow, what a great thing to be, for a teacher to say that. So this Kalama Sutta is a man's charter of freedom. This makes Buddhism the most tolerant of traditions and religions and philosophies. The Buddha recognized human dignity and freedom to think. Now the Buddha was a unique human being. He was the profoundest of all thinkers and an unexcelled speaker. He was the most compassionate and tolerant teacher. He was perfect in virtue, the embodiment of highest morality. Now we'll talk about the theory of reality. Now Buddhism recognizes the reality of the material world and its impact on experience. Now our body, the form, is only a physical basis for the conscious mind to operate. And life is a byproduct of matter. The socio-economic environment conditions human relationships and affects morality. Now at that time, everyone believed in the concept of a self. And here it was very strong, the concept of the self. And here in a period where everyone was very talking about the concept of the self, the Buddha discarded the concept of the self. He said, "There is nothing substantial in a self or a soul." And he analyzed the human personality in the aspect of experience. So he said, "There is feeling, perception, intention, and cognition." So with the form, body, so that means he analyzed the human being into the five aggregates. So the five aggregates are the form, the body, feelings, perceptions, intention, and consciousness or cognition. He said, "Man is motivated to act out of greed." We all know that, right? We all act out of greed. So what do we have because of our greed? Our desire to gratify our senses. So we are every minute, that's what we are doing, aren't we? We are gratifying these five senses. So our sensual and sexual gratification is of the utmost to all beings. And there's another thing that we are motivated to act out of. What is that? What is that?
Aversion.
Yes, hatred. That's right. Hatred, aversion. And then what do we do because of that? Because of our desire to act out of hatred, what do? We have the desire to destroy and eliminate things that we don't like. Isn't that what happens with everyone, every day, every minute? we are like this magnet, up and down, attaching to things we like and pushing. So we are fighting. First we do it with ourselves, then we fight with others, and then and in the large world, that's what countries fight. War is all about too, because of their greed, because they are acting through greed, and because they are acting through aversion, hatred. So that is where again the peace message of the Buddha comes. Now man and our natural environment are both in a state of continual flux. Everything is changing all the time. And that is another very difficult thing for us to see. We don't see that. In fact, only yesterday we were talking of that, and it was very difficult for an ordinary person when they say everything is changing all the time. It's very difficult. And even when they are given simple examples, they say it's very hard to see that. So we were talking about, if you look outside, you can see leaves falling, fruit ripening and falling, all these changes in the, especially in Minnesota, the four seasons we can see. But it's very difficult to people to grasp that concept of everything is changing. So, in fact, I asked, now, are you the same person that you were born? Oh, that's a different thing. That's what they say. No, that's a different thing. That doesn't mean that everything is changing. So it's very difficult for us to realize, see, our body is changing all the time, and what else is changing all the time? Our feelings are changing all the time, right? One minute we'll be very happy, the next minute we will be sad, upset, angry, whatever. And then our perception changes. And our intentions change all the time too. And our cognition, our consciousness changes. So everything is changing all the time. And what happens because, what do you think happens because of all this change that is happening all the time? You think existence, you think life is satisfactory? How many of you think your life is satisfactory? That's another thing they had a hard time. But no, my life is fine. I'm very happy. Yeah, that's what you say. But are you really happy? But are you really happy all the time? No, it's changing. One minute. So existence is very unsatisfactory. And to really let you realize that in this time, how many of you would have changed your posture 10, 15, 20 times by now from the time you sat here? Okay. If things look satisfactory, why are you changing? It's because it's unsatisfactory. So when you change that posture, you say, ah, this is so happy. And then, a few minutes, okay, you change. Then again. So we are all the time, we can't see. Even that little minute, we are changing all the time. So because of that, that hides the unsatisfactoriness. Because we don't see that. We see only the satisfactoriness. So because of things changing, and if everything is changing and everything is unsatisfactory, can there be a permanent thing anywhere in within you? No, it cannot be. But what do? We have that strong desire to grasp at something that is not there. We grasp it and we say, and we grasp it and we believe that there is something very permanent within us that is doing all these things. See, actually what we are doing is we are grasping to an illusion. It's that grasping that, because of the grasping, we are holding on to something. So, now owing to the causal factors that exist in nature, man is in a state of becoming, and there is continuity of the individuality. That is how we go from birth to birth, going round in samsara. So, and we are influenced by our moral and immoral behavior, our wholesome and our unwholesome acts, because those are the ones that result in pleasant and unpleasant consequences. So we are also conditioned by our psychological past, going back to our past lives. We are also influenced by our heredity and by the impact of our environment. Now, but since, according to Buddhism, life is not predetermined, so we all have the chance, the capability to change our own nature and to change our environment. So now we'll talk about morality that the Buddha talked of. He emphatically taught the importance of morality. He taught us to exercise thoughts of selflessness, loving kindness, and harmlessness, and moral responsibility. Now, we'll all think, see, for us to have moral responsibility, what must be there? We, even though our actions are conditioned, we must have some freedom. If we didn't have the freedom, then there's no point in even talking of moral responsibility. How can we take moral responsibility if we didn't have the freedom? If everything was determined, talking of moral responsibility is of no use. Now, arahatship is the attainment of human perfection. Now, for us to understand what right action is, the Buddha said, whatever action that you do, if it is beneficial to you and to others, then that is right action. So it has to be beneficial not only to you, it has to be beneficial to you and to others. So what are these actions? They are to consist in refraining evil, doing what is good, and cleansing our minds. So in a nutshell, that is the whole teaching of the Buddha. Cleansing your mind, abstaining from doing evil, cultivating good, and purifying your mind. So purifying the mind means changing our attitude, changing the basis of our motivation from greed, hatred, and ignorance to self-service, compassion, and understanding. Now the Buddha showed us the way to achieve this change in motivation by a process of self-analysis, meditation, and self-development. The aim of the Buddhist morality is the attainment of human happiness and social harmony. So the Buddhist theory of reality and moral teachings are summed up in the Four Noble Truths. Now the social and political philosophy of the Buddha is equally relevant and enlightening. The Buddha was the first thinker in history to preach the doctrine of equality. Now, when he talks of equality, he did not mean that all beings are physically and psychologically alike. We know that we are not. That's what his whole teaching of karma is. People are not physically and psychologically alike. There's a lot of all variations are due to karma. But, he said, all beings have the capacity and the potentiality to aspire to the highest goal. Whether it's a poor man or a rich man or a saint or a criminal, we all have the same capacity, we all have the same potential within us to aspire to the highest goal. So he said, that in itself is enough to warrant for their being treated equally. So that is what he meant by equality. That is enough to warrant all beings to be treated equally because of their capacity to, because they have the potential to reach the highest goal. So because of that, all human beings should and must be treated with equality and with human dignity. All should have the equal opportunity in the enjoyment of all human rights, laws, education, employment, and all other things that we as human beings do. Now, this that was said by the Buddha 2600 years ago is very, very relevant today. So we cannot say, oh, that was way, way back and it doesn't apply to us. I think it applies to each and every one of us exactly the same way that it applied then. So this, in brief, is the message of the teachings of the Buddha. This is the value and the full significance of the Buddha's enlightenment. And this is what the world has yet to realize. Thank you. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, Namassara. Okay, there's about 10 minutes for questions.
About satisfaction, I kind of have a perspective that I'm oftentimes satisfied, but as a human I have a wonderful gift of choosing the direction of change in my life.
Uh-huh.
And so by changing the position I sit in, to use your example, it isn't so much
that
I'm
simple.
Unsatisfied, it's that I'm choosing the direction of change.
So why do you change if you are satisfied?
Because I see merit in stretching certain muscles.
Because there's pain, right? Because there's pain in the muscles, and you are uncomfortable in because of that pain.
I guess that's
you. Okay. So that is only a simple thing that I gave, so that everyone can relate to that. But that is there in not only the simple things, even in the big things that we in life. Okay. Yes?
Thank you so much for your speech today. I really appreciate it. I have a question that
yes.
I often turn over in my mind.
Yeah.
And I have my own kind of answer, but I'm interested to hear your perspective.
Yes.
The perspective of Buddhist powers. So, one part of the Buddha's story that I always kind of struggle with as a woman and just as a person, and I've heard other people talk about this as well, is the fact that right after his son was born, he was like, I gotta go.
Yes.
You know, I gotta leave.
Yeah. That's right.
And I mean, I have a son, and I know exactly how that feels.
Yeah.
Okay? You're like, I think he named his son Ball and Chain.
Rahul.
Right? Yeah.
Rahul.
He was like, okay, I'm stuck in this world.
Yeah.
So, it just always sort of grates on me when I hear this, you know, this amazing person who went through all of this and found this path that has so enriched my life and through experience that you talked about, I feel like it's true.
Uh-huh.
I also feel like there are these moments in my own life and other people's lives too that I see them, you know, struggling with that aversion and desire to follow through on some of their commitments. Which is not always convenient or pretty, but I don't know, maybe it's my own personal question, the nature of existence and, you know, procreation and all these things, but as a woman, like, that part of the story always, and you put it like, well, okay, he could, at that moment, he could have chosen to sort of get wrapped up in are again choosing more worldly life. Kind of, I was thinking about when you were talking, and what I was thinking was, okay, well, that was how he attained enlightenment. Like, that was maybe his path or whatever, and the path, his story itself, it doesn't mean that, like, each of us are going to follow that path. The point is, he found the way, and I don't know, can you shed some light on that aspect?
Okay, if you take only this life,
right.
But that's not the whole picture.
Okay.
Think of all. See, actually, it is way, way, way back during the Buddha Dipankara that he got the prophecy to become a Buddha. And then from that life, from there itself till so many lives, he and Yasodhara were together as husband and wife. Even as so they were both going practicing this path, and then again you have to take the social structure of India at that time. Okay, the father was a king. Okay, and he lived, I mean, in there, the whole family is there to support. You don't get, unlike here, you get married and you're on your own, no one to help you and support you. You live with your in-laws. You are in their house. You are all, everyone is together. So he's just because he went, all the child would have lost was a father figure. But the grandfather was acting like a father. And the mother knew, I mean, they knew that this is going to happen someday. So they prevented him from doing that, but they all were prepared for that. And then what happened was, after 7 years, when he came back, and when the child mother sent the child to ask for the inheritance that he gave was, okay, come with me and become a monk. Okay. Now that made the grandfather very, very upset. So grandfather said, I just barely got over my grief of losing you.
Right.
Now you took my grandson too. And he made him make, from that time, that was when, now you cannot get ordination without the parent's permission. He said, can you please put say that no one can be ordained without the permission of the parents. So if you are young, you have to, and if you are married, you have to get your spouse's permission. You can't, that is one question that they have. Do you have the permission? So if you look at the broad picture, it is, and that would have been, that would be, and then he, not only, so he had practiced 10 perfections, not one perfection, 10 perfections. So see what a, how potent his a personality he would have had to be able to overcome all that and go.
You mean 10, I'm sorry, 10 perfections, you're saying 10 lifetimes?
No, 10 perfections. Okay, if you want to know the 10 perfections, he practiced generosity, morality, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and equanimity. So, if we practice only one, and if you see someone who has practiced only one, you will see, oh, what a lovely person, what a great person that person is. Can you imagine someone who had practiced all 10 to the utmost limit? I mean, you couldn't find a more generous person than that. You couldn't find a more compassionate person than that. See, his compassion was so great, he thought, and he had practiced equanimity too. So it was, his picture was all beings to the one, what was greater to in his mind. Yeah, okay. Yeah. I'll come to you after he had this, yes. That is one of the first things that a Buddhist learns, is to forgive. I mean, not once, not twice. He said, if someone does the same thing to you 100 times, forgive that 100 times too. So what more can forgiveness can there be? I think Buddhists are more forgiving than any other person that I know. Uh-huh. Yeah. No, they don't go and, they don't ask. Now, see, they think of the, in a Christian way. Okay, see, see, sometimes people mistake the karma as punishment. That is why they say there is no forgiveness. See, you are forgiven for what you have done. And they say, you have to ask forgiveness from your own self too, the Buddha says. But that does not mean the karma is someone from above giving punishing or yes. So it is a natural law. Like if I throw a glass, However much I ask for forgiveness, can that glass stay without breaking? The glass will break. Or if I tip my glass, this glass of water, and I say, please forgive me, don't fall and wet the whole place, can the glass water will stay there? No, it's a natural, it's a consequence, it's a cause and effect is there. That has nothing to do with forgiveness. But if you, because the forgiveness, he said, if someone cuts you, separates you from limb to limb with a chainsaw, yes, if you cannot forgive that man, you have not practiced Buddhism properly. So forgiveness is very, very big in...
Huh? The Buddha nature is inherited by beings, even someone who does you...
Yeah. Now the word Buddha nature is comes from Zen Buddhism. The Theravada don't use it as Buddha nature. They say the potential to become safe. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. We have to leave it here.
Yes.
I thought there were some more questions. I don't know if you'd be willing to stay later. We have to have an official closing. It's 9 o'clock. Do you share the marriage?
Yes, I do.
And then after you do that, then I'll just have a few short announcements.
Okay. So what we can do is we are going to share whatever, all these goodness that we have done with all the devas and the celestial beings. So I'm going to recite the Pali recitation and we'll share merits first with all the devas and the celestial beings and later on with all our departed friends and relatives and parents. Okay. Akasatta jabumatta deva naga mahitika punyantanganamoditva jiran rakkantu sasana. Akasatta jabumatta deva naga mahitika punyantanganamoditva jiran rakkantu desana. Akasatta jabumatta deva naga mahitika punyantanganamoditva jiran rakkantu vampara. Etavata jammehi sampadam punya sampadam. Sabbe devanamodantu sabbadam patisiddhya. Etavata jammehi sampadam punya sampadam. Sabbe bhutanamodantu sabbadam patisiddhya. Etavata jammehi sampadam punya sampadam. Sabbe sattanamodantu sabbadam patisiddhya. Idam me nyati nam hotu sukhita hontu natyo. Nyati nam hotu sukhita hontu natyo. Idam me nyati nam hotu sukhita hontu natyo. And all of you, by the power of all this that you did, may you all be blessed with good health, long life, peace, and happiness. Sadhu, 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 buddham, dhammam, sangham, namassa.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.